I said, sort this stuff up. And, you know, back in the 1950s there and before that, they were sitting there really coming up with great ideas. I don't mean to haul you, Barry, but I just got to mention this one thing. This switching arrangement that they have to make a switch go. They've got a coil in there. I've always thought of this, you know, look at my dipoles. Maybe I want to put another dipole in. I don't want to run another coax cable. No, you could have the basic setup, just like what they have with the switch, to switch between dipoles. For instance, all they have is two coils, and it's really one solenoid and two individual coils. One coil is run one way, the other coil is run the other way. And even though it's AC, of course, it doesn't matter. When that gets, you know, when one coil is energized, this solenoid goes in one direction. The other coil is energized, you know, it's three connections on the switch. The solenoid goes in the opposite direction, you know, and it locks into place. You could put on the end of that thing, instead of a switch going back, you could put a little relay contact on it, and you'd be able to switch between different coax. I said this is exactly what I would be. You know, you could actually homebrew something like this to switch. You know, make your dipole switch from one to the other. I think they were very creative way back then. Amazing. Back to you, Dick.
CAV.
Yeah, Mr. CAV. I bet you're a trained man, and tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, not so much a train man, but I do happen to have a hot internet connection here. And yes, I do have trains, but unfortunately I lost my family train, so I have Mike's train out, train, PH train, with the all computer control, which is pretty wild for train stuff. But anyway, I did a quick search on the net, and I couldn't find it saying explicitly, but they're implying that it's a constant DC voltage. Basically, that when you hit the whistle button, it puts the DC voltage onto the track, and that there's just a relay that implied that it was a very simple coil that's pulling a metal plate that activates the whistle or whatever it is. Actually, and following on to the previous show, and I apologize, I didn't get all the call signs, but they actually, the website that I found was talking about how to kind of hijack the whistle symbol to do a lot of other things. In relation to trains, which is kind of one step short of what he was talking about, to kind of hijack it to some whole different applications. So, anyway, that's my thought to my answer to your CAV.
Oh, EAV. I think I heard that sort of CAV. Very fine, Bernie. When you're putting up the coax cable, DC voltages to run remote preamplifiers, or positive DC, negative DC, different magnitudes of DC, DC mixed with AC and whatever, you could do all kinds of remote switching functions. That's what Paul is slowly discovering that they were doing way back in the 50s with his Lionel train. And when I had my 16 Yagis up there on 432 megacycles, and I had a bunch of relays built into the middle of that phasing harness, I had the ability, by sending voltages up the coax, I could switch all the relays in such a way that I fed all the power to one single Yagi, one vertical string of four Yagis, or all 16 Yagis. I was flipping the relays in such a way that the impedances stayed matched, and I fed the signal to how many Yagis I wanted, and it was an electronic zoom control. And I was doing it by sending the voltages up the coax. Real fun type project. By the way, when it comes to simple things like this in the dark ages, the biggest eye-opening that I've had in a long time is back in January. I took the first vacation in 20 years, and I went down to my cousin's house in Naples, Florida, and from there we went to, I can't think of the name of the town now, it's just north of Naples, where they have the Witcher Laboratory of Thomas Alva Edison. And you look at his laboratory, which is now a museum. By modern standards, you say, man, this place is primitive. Old-fashioned, wrought wooden benches, his cot that he slept on for an hour every afternoon, because he would work 18 hours a day, but take a couple of naps during the middle of the day. He worked 18 hours a day, at least 6, if not 7 days a week, throughout most of his life, but with his very primitive test equipment, very primitive facilities, power was coupled around the building by way of a leather belt going over wooden pulleys in order to run things like drill presses and sanding machines and whatever. How in the world, in some simple stuff, he made 1,572 patents, 75 patents one particular year, made so many really great inventions. The most unsung thing he ever did was Brockton, Connecticut. He hooked up a three-wire power system to power the shoe factories in that town, as well as the lights in that town. You go to the Wright website, and you read the details of what was never made public about what he did. Everybody knows about what he did in downtown Manhattan to put DC voltage up the street and to light some light bulbs. He had a much bigger, much more successful operation with AC three-wire wiring in Brockton, Connecticut, Brockton, Massachusetts, an extremely successful project where portions of that installation that he did in 1883 is still in operation today. If you go to the right website, I can indicate to you, when you listen to the philosophy of Thomas Edison, where it's about three solid pages taken out of his notebook, where he, after he's in the middle of a project, and he feels like taking a break, and he writes down a couple of lines of his philosophy of life and philosophy of work, and you read that stuff, and you say, wow, how the hell did that guy do all that? Most of it was attitude. I mean, he knew that there's ways of getting around it. That guy, I don't care that he never had a ham radio license, that had the ham philosophy. He could do an awful lot with very little. And boy, he did it very successfully. By the way, back in the old days, when it comes to telegraph systems, they would put positive DC voltage, negative DC voltage, and AC voltage down the line in order to transmit multiple Morse code signals simultaneously. You have one set of clackers in the receiving site that are listening to the positive, one clack listening to the negative, another set of clackers listening to the AC. They were doing things like that on simple two-wire systems, sending down multiple signals. That's what Lionel is doing with your trains there, Paul. Okay, let's find out about the website for a Hewlett-Packard 28S simulation. Barry is back from cooking his salmon. Into Mike Bravo, K2LAW in the tech man.
Okay, real good. Actually, the salmon was great. Okay, and it was sockeye salmon, by the way. What you're looking for is HP calculator emulators for the PC. After many tries, that's what works. And the site which has every HP, by the way, it all comes from England. You're right about that. The Brits seem to love this stuff. HTTP /www.hpcalc.org/HP48/PC/emulators. Worry about the HP48. The 28S is in there. You want me to repeat that?
No, I think I got that. And by way of those words, you'll find it on Google also, or on Google search. Back to you if you want to repeat it one more time, just to be sure, Barry.
Okay, yeah, just to go directly to what I found, where it seems to be the best of what I ran into, was www.hpcalc.org/HP48/PC/emulators with an S. And what you, and if you want to look for other stuff, because randomly it's called HP Calculator Emulators for the PC. That's how I ran into it. It took a bunch of typing to come up with that one.
Okay, I got it then. I'm down here. My boy, it should be a much better signal than we
get. Absolutely. Now I hear you on the input as well as the output, and you're posting. You need an elevator to easily get you down to the basement there, Rich. Okay, I'm sure Mel has got some more juicy emails, so back to you, Mel. Looks like we've covered calculators, Lionel trains, a little bit of Thomas Edison, calculator emulators. Boy, we got far afield here. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey,
all right,
go beat. We covered, let me see what's down here. Yeah, there's a couple other things. The one other one there, perhaps, the spot here. I think we better leave, because it's going to get late. I don't know if we should get into questions on Q. I believe these are all questions of people that are trying to upgrade So I guess the type of things are a little confusing to somebody, you know, that's new at it. So I've got one here on the Q and a question about measuring Q. So I don't know if you want to pursue it any further tonight, Dick, because it's after 11 already, over.
Q is one of my favorite subjects. Fire away.
Okay. Newcomer, but it is okay. Yes, he says, I once heard that you can measure Q with a grid-dip meter. I recently inherited a grid-dip meter. I do not have the paperwork on it, but I'm sure you fellows have used grid-dip meters for a long time. How would I get an idea of the Q by just using a grid-dip meter measurement? There was a way, I remember, Dick, but I don't know, maybe you would like to make the comment first on it, over.
Yeah, that's not an easy one. If you had two identical coils side by side, physically identical in size, and inside one of them was hidden a resistor which was lowering the Q, and the second one didn't have a resistor, it was the one with the higher Q, but they're still both inside of a black box, so to speak, and you go near each one of them with a grid dip meter, here's what you would find. First, you would standardize the distance between your grid dip meter sensing coil and the device you're measuring. Say, for instance, you make both of them 2 inches away. You would discover that with the high Q coil, you would get a much deeper dip, and if you wanted to, you could find out you would get the dip easily recognizable from a greater distance. So a coil with higher Q, you could say, radiates a stronger field over a longer distance, and the grid dip meter can couple to it more easily. And this ties in with your loop antenna, Mel. Your loop antenna, because you've made it out of low resistance materials, because your loop hits resonance at 80 meters. If you were using a grid dip meter, you would find out you could locate the grid dip meter further away from your particular coil versus one that's not built quite as well, your particular loop antenna, if you were grid dipping it. And therefore, you would discover that it's got a larger magnetic field that goes further in space, and that partially explains why you've got the full 8,000 square feet of effective capture area with that tiny little loop antenna. So, higher Q, stronger magnetic field, further away, easier to sense. But now, so if you've got two coils and you want to find out which one's got higher Q, the grid dip meter will easily show you that. But now if you've got two coils where one's got a large diameter and one's got a small diameter, that's going to add another factor that makes it a little bit more confusing. Also, this is a frequency-sensitive phenomenon. In other words, if I had a coil that's resonating at 80 meters with a Q of 100, and if I had a coil which is really a half turn, so to speak, that's resonating at 146 megacycles, and it's got a Q of 100, you would find that you have to use very different sensing coils on the grid dip meter itself, and they in turn have different ranges. So range at which you get a particular depth of the dip is one way to tell how far you can sweep it up and down in frequency and stay into the dip is another clue. The higher clue coil, when you adjust for the distance that gives you a dip of, let's say, half tail. The higher Q coil, you can't move the megacycle dial as far before you come out of the dip. Whereas with the lower Q coil, you have to cup repeater.
Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
With the lower Q coil, you have to couple tighter with the grid dip meter to get a half-scale dip. And now when you're coupled tighter on that lower Q coil, you'll notice that you have to move the dial a lot more megacycles before you come out of the dip. So these are clues, but to make it quantitative, I think, is a little bit difficult. But a guy who's got a lot of experience with his particular grid dip meter would know right away, hey, that's a good coil, and boy, that one's pretty yucky. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, you're right, very right. That's the one with the real steep, you know, sharp dip, and then you move away with the with the grid zipper, still get a nice pronounced dip with the coil, definitely that has the higher Q. But the old time is this. In fact, I saw the demonstration, how I remember how it was done. You have two coils, both for the same frequency. One is wound on a little larger diameter, a little heavier wire and all, and they both dip on the same frequency. But you'd like to know, what is the, you know, better, you know, how much better is the Q with the one coil over the other? What is a ballpark number, Dick, over?
Okay, I'm not quite sure what you're asking when you say ballpark number. Ballpark number of megacycles of movement staying in dip, ballpark number of distance to the coil, ballpark number of diameter of coil. I'm not quite sure which question you were asking there, Mel. Back to you.
Okay, so saying which one would have the, you know, which one is the Q? Let's say one has a Q. You'd like to know the number Q somewhere, like say 20, 30, or whatever it is. And the other one, what is the Q? In other words, you want to know how much better in number-wise is the Q of one over the other, but you have two almost exact coils that more or less dip for the same frequency. You know, or you want to evaluate what's the improvement from when you read this to make another coil out of some maybe better material or whatever, better dielectric or wound it on or whatever. You don't have to be the situation. I want a number over.
Okay, I think I see where you're going here. Although I'm going to give it to you left-handedly. What determines the Q of a coil? And that is one of the definitions of Q of an inductor is X sub L divided by R. X sub L is inductive reactance at your favorite frequency, and R is the equivalent series resistance. A little bit of a problem there. In the case of a simple multi-turn coil made out of, we'll say, 18-gauge wire, most of that series resistance is really the combination of the ohmic resistance of the wire combined with the skin effect, the fact that the RF energy only flows to the nearest top 1,000th or 10,000th of an inch of the copper, and the rest of the copper, the RF energy, never gets down there. So what is the equivalent series resistance? Now, you notice the X sub L is the numerator, and divide by resistance is the denominator. So if you could keep the resistance the same, but make the XL larger, you'd be increasing the Q. You can do that by winding more turns of a larger diameter. When you go to the appropriate chapter of the Amateur Radio's handbook, the Handbook for Radio Amateurs, there's a section in there where they've got a formula where it'll tell you how many microhenries you're going to get out of the coil. And the raw data you put into it is what's the diameter of the coil, what's the number of turns of the coil, what's the spacing of the turn. And I don't think they ask for the diameter of the wire. Just how many turns, diameter of the hold-on solenoid coil, and the spacing between the turns. You plug in all those numbers, and it comes out with microhenries. And so you can play with those, with that formula, for various physical configurations for your inductor, where in all cases you're using roughly the same amount of wire, but you're winding it with large diameter, small diameter, a lot of turns, not so many turns, close spacing, far spacing. You're going to discover that the closer the spacing, the better. The larger the diameter, the better. The higher the number of the turns, the better. And of course, there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. So that's the way you make a coil higher and higher in Q. You do a good job of winding a coil out of, say, 14-gauge wire. Getting a coil that has a Q of 1,000 is doable. Not easy, but doable. And when you start winding a coil out of a large diameter like you would with a 6-meter hula hoop, and you make it out of 3/8 of an inch diameter copper tubing, and you use the right kinds of turns, again, I think you can get a very large Q number. In the case of a capacitor, the Q is a function of X sub C divided by R again. And every capacitor has got some equivalent resistance to it somewhere. When you put your best capacitor across your best inductor, and you now want the highest Q resonator, maximizing the Q of each one of your individual components, your inductor and capacitor, can help you get there. You've now got a conflict of interest also. In most real radio circuits, you're going to want to shield your resonator. If it's a transmitter, you've got to put a cage around it so that somebody doesn't touch the high voltage. If it's a receiver, you're putting a shield around it to make sure it's only receiving the signal from the antenna and not any other stray signals from the rest of the circuits or from the shack itself. So in either case, when you put a shield around a coil, you're canceling some of the magnetic field that would have been external to the coil. You're cutting down the inductive reactance of the coil. Therefore, you're lowering the Q. I can take a beautiful coil that has a beautiful high Q, put it in a nice shielded can, and I may end up with half the Q. Once it's in a shielded can of given dimensions, there's a brand new optimum diameter, a brand new optimum turn number that's going to give you the highest possible Q in that particular shielded enclosure. So if you and I were in the factory that's making the world's best Schneider Nadel IF can, which is a kind of a shielded resonator, there's a bit of art and science to winding that coil. You and I would probably choose a pi winding technique of lips wire for the IF can that's in our particular shielded enclosure to get the highest possible Q in that environment. As you can see, there's more to the problem than first meets the eye. Maybe this is some of what you were looking for, Mel. KQKEY, KQRIW, wait for the beep.
No, I think what this is, KQKEY, what this guy is looking for, I got it, because he's an old timer, and he's trying to catch it. Okay, Roger. I know what you're alluding to. He wants to use just the grip disc here. He's got two coils. They seem to dip exactly on the same frequency. He wants to know of these two coils, which one has the higher Q, and by how much? How much is the difference? How many points difference is one Q better than one coil better than the other, Dick? He's trying to catch us. And I know what he's alluding to, Dick. There is a trick to doing this with the grid that feeder over.
Okay. I know when you use that grid dip meter, you're choosing the right distance that gives you a known amount of dip, like half scale. You're choosing the right sweeping of the dial that has the right number of megacycles of sweeping between the upper end and the lower end of the dip. These are all strong clues. When you find the coil with a higher Q, you can be further away, or if you're at a standard distance, you'll get a deeper dip on the higher Q coil. You'll be able to tune it a different number of megacycles. And I think the one with the higher Q, you can only tune it a smaller number of megacycles before it jumps out of that dip. And there's also a kind of funny interaction that takes place. I mean, if the highest Q of the whole universe, when you're making the measurement, was your Millen grid dip meter itself, everything becomes fairly simple. In the real world, occasionally the coil you're measuring is slightly higher in Q than the coil of your grid dip meter itself. And when that happens, you get a peculiar interaction between the two in which when you turn the dial clockwise, it behaves one way. When you turn the dial counterclockwise, it behaves another way. You get sort of a sticky action, is the best way I can describe it, where the higher Q coil that you're measuring dominates, and for a while you're adjusting the dial and it appears as though nothing is happening, if you know what I mean. Because of this, the external Q network is dominating and predicting what frequency the thing is going to be on, regardless of where you set the dial, within a certain range. And let me think now, is there another way that you can do this? Yeah. You could put a standard known resistor across the coil when you make the measurement, and I think with enough smart, this will help you determine which is the higher Q coil under working conditions. I think there's also ways of putting a known high-quality capacitor across the coil and forcing it into resonance, which I think you've done already. In order to use a grid dip meter, the coil must resonate. So you're putting a known capacitor across the coil to resonate it. And by the way, once you find out the size capacitor you put across the coil and what frequency you dip that, you know what is the inductance in microhenries or nanohenries of your particular coil. So some of this helps, but I'll bet your George has got another trick that we haven't hit yet. And so, has he given us any hints? Back to you, Mel. Wait for the beam.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Hey, no, you're right. No, everything you said is right, but we want a number. How do you get a number? Two coils. What's the difference in the Q? Which one? Give me a number. Is one 10 points higher, 5 points higher? What? How do you get the number? Which is using the grid dip meter, not putting any capacitors, no resistance, just with the grid dip meter. Do you know the trick? Over.
I'm beginning to think that George has tapped us on this one, Mel. I'm slowly concluding that he stumped us. I think he therefore gets the prize. I think you and I had to supply him a ticket to his favorite restaurant for him and his lady friend for a nice meal, because I think he stumped us on this one, Mel. Go ahead.
I had to think back, Dick, but I remember the demonstration. Believe it or not, I remember the demonstration, how this is done. And it's a long, long time ago, and the son of a gun, these old radio guys, were pretty sharp characters. And I saw this demonstration once, Dick, and it came to me, and I caught him. I told him once, and he says, you got it. He says, but I'll bet these guys in the tech net won't know how to do it. So I can't take credit for originating this procedure. But I saw this procedure, Dick, and it's a very cute procedure, over.
Okay. Teach me how, Mel. I'm in the listening mode.
Hey, you know, the old timers, they have formulas. And I'm telling you, I marked down a lot of, you know, these formulas. I got the formulas that are real cute. All right, normally I could say it was old Q would be 2 pi FL over R, resistor factor. That's the hard thing to find, the resistor factor. What they did in those days, they had a formula they came up with, Q equals F for frequency divided by F1, F2, Dick. Q equals F divided by F1 minus F2. Did you ever hear that formula, over?
Absolutely. I use that one all the time. And the way it's usually written down is Q equals F0. Divided by F2 minus F1. So Q equals F0 divided by open parentheses F2 minus F1. F2 is the higher frequency of 3 dB roll-off. F1 is the lower frequency of 3 dB roll-off. F0 is the center frequency, and I think we're talking about geometric center frequency here when it comes to super broadband. So when it comes to a resonating network, that's called the center frequency divided by 3 dB bandwidth. That's one of the 4 or 5 definitions of Q. I use that one all the time. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, see, we got them. You got the answer, Dick. That's it. Except they did a little different. Okay, but based on the same principle, they would take the coil, they back off if especially it's got a heavy dip, like you say, it'll have that lag, you know, all of a sudden, and it pops out. So what they'll do is they'll reduce the coupling once they got the sense of frequency. And, you know, so that way they can get a more of a sharp spot on the center frequency. And they know that center frequency, as like you said, the F0, F sub 0. They now take this the grid dip and move it higher in frequency and measure that frequency, the higher frequency, where it gets to 30% of the dip. Now you go back the other way, go back into the dip, and go to 30% below that point, below the dip. You take those two frequencies, you subtract them, one from the other, and you divide it by the F0, the dip frequency, Dick, and you'll get the Q, over.
That's a beautiful technique. When you do the modern equivalent with that, with a network analyzer is the Cadillac of grid dip meters. and network analyzers go up to 400 gigahertz if you buy the one that's made in France. The ones that you make from the United States go up to 115 gigahertz. So what the network analyzer is doing is acting like a signal generator. So far it's like a good bit meter. It sends the signal with direct connection by coax cable into your resonator or your network of interest, and it looks at the reflection coefficient called S11, voltage reflection coefficient, the Greeley-Dizois. So if the device under measurement was a perfect 50 ohm load, you would send signal down the cable, nothing would come back, you'd get an S11 of minus a zillion dB. If it was a short circuit or an open circuit, all the signal you send down the cable hits the device under test, all of it reflects back, and you'll get an S11 of 0 dB, reflection coefficient of 0 dB. That means you send 1 volt down, and you get 1 volt coming back at you. So with every realistic network, the machine sweeps in frequency, plots it on the screen, and now you may see that the maximum dip in the middle is, we'll say, 20 dB down. That's something like a 1.05 standing wave ratio, a 1.1, I forget the exact numbers now. And you look for the frequencies above and below where the reflection coefficient changes by some given amount. I'm not sure if it's 3 dB in that particular case. So a modern network analyzer does what the grid dip meter used to do, and it does it with 2 or 3 decimal places of accuracy, and it's a lot more fun machine to use. That parallel kilowatt amplifier that I built in 1970 and it appeared in April and May issue 1972 QST magazine, how did I hit resonance on the grid circuit and how did I hit resonance on the plate circuit? Well, AIO owned a Millen grid dip meter, a UHF version that went to, I think, 800 or 1,000 megacycles. I took the cover on the grid circuit or the cover on the plate circuit and skewed the cover a little bit off to one side so there was a small gap in one corner. And the little half loop coil, half turn coil that was inside a plastic on top of the grid dip meter, I snuck it inside of that slit that I made by sliding the top cover, and I moved the grid dip meter dial back and forth to find resonance while operating the controls on the amplifier. And that's how I literally first hit resonance on the plate circuit and first hit resonance on the grid circuit. Because if you don't get them both in the ballpark to begin with, you can't get the drive signal into the tube if you can't make the grid resonate. And by the same token, you'll never make the plate circuit work right if you can't make hit resonance with it. And since I was working with these strip line circuits, high power, 3-inch ground plane spacing grid, tri-plate strip line circuits, 3-inch ground plane spacing. For the first time in my life, I didn't really know when I'm operating those clamping capacitors what resonance would look like, what the right length was. I could do a rough calculation. I knew how many picofarads the tube was supposed to have, and I could calculate how long the line length would get shortened because of the presence of the tube. Let me drop for a second. But the tube is not a lumped capacitor. The 4CX250B tube has, as I remember, 14.5 picofarad on the grid, 4.5 picofarad on the plate. That's the good news. But the 4.5 picofarad is not within a 1/8 of an inch diameter circle, so to speak. The tube itself has got an altitude of about 1.5 inches, 2 inches. And so the capacitance of the tube is spread over the 1.5 or 2 inches of altitude of the tube. So when you connect that tube to an 8-inch wide piece of strip line that's acting as a resonator, because it is a distributed capacitance of a particular crazy shape, the way the plate line will resonate is a little bit different than a simple calculation knowing that it's supposed to be 4.5 picofarad will be. So I had a lot of fun with that grid dip meter in 1970 when I was designing that circuit. And this is getting close to what George is asking you. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, you're right. In the 1950s, that grid dip meter with the old timers knew what to do with it. They measured, like you say, they could find the value of a capacitor, variable capacitor. They could check the range of it. So they could do all kinds of things, measure, chokes. It was unlimited. And yet, It seems to have, you know, disappeared, really, almost. You hardly hear anyone, you know, anymore buying a grid meter. Even there, I don't know if it's more manufactured. Is somebody still putting out a grid meter? Who possibly is, well, Eastkid is gone. Ico is gone. Millen is gone. So, I don't know. Is there somebody putting out a grid meter? I can say I've seen the demonstration. This guy, that's how far back I remember this. He did it in front of his receiver, where he would got the frequency of the dip and noted it on his receiver. And to get the accuracy, he did this process of the upper and lower dip, the upper and lower measurements from the dip, and used his receiver as the, you know, to get the, as close to the precise frequency. And he was within, I think within 5% of the Q of that coil of what had been tested in the laboratory up to time by with a Q meter. So let me tell you something. These guys really do something. And for a minute, it's cool me, and I'm thinking about this and thinking about this, and I said, oh, boy, this one I got to throw out on TechNet because I have a feeling that this is going to be one that we will remember. How clever they were. Now, you know, the modern ham today doesn't realize that you can do a lot of testing on your linear amplifier, checking it, without putting the plate voltage on with a grid meter ticket. You don't, yet you don't hear, you know, you hardly hear of these things anymore, over.
You'd be amazed how much testing you can do before turning it on. By just turning on the filament and applying no voltages, you can easily resonate the grid. You can resonate the plate, and if you're smart enough, you can adjust the neutralizing network to get highest neutralization settings for the amplifier, giving you the best stability under working conditions. So there's a lot of testing you can do before you ever apply signal or B plus to the amplifier. Grid dip meters are the way you used to do it until network analyzers came along, and now one Hewlett-Packard, among other companies, invented techniques for being able to, with high accuracy, measure the phase of signals on a line. And it doesn't, and they have the ability to separate the signal going out versus the signal coming back and measure the phase of one versus the other. The vector voltmeter of Hewlett-Packard of roughly, oh, I guess that came out around 1970 or so, 1965, I had an awful lot of fun using a vector voltmeter, which was a phase-sensitive, specific power meter, voltage-sensing meter. That was the beginning, in my mind, of network analyzers. And the next step now is to combine a signal generator with a vector voltmeter, and it's called network analyzer. I remember a company, other than Hewlett-Packard, was starting to come out with that kind of a product in roughly 1970. And it looked to me like it was taking a bunch of test equipment you normally put on the bench and combining it all in one box. Vector voltmeter, signal generator, specific voltage and current measuring capability, forward and reverse ratio measuring capability. Put that all together in one box, and it's called network analyzer. Because network analyzers are now so popular and there's so many brand names, they work so well calibrated, I think we will almost never see a grid dip meter anymore. I own a Heathkit grid dip meter. I know that Millen went out of business, Hewlett-Packard went out of business. The very last grid dip meter that I'm aware of was the Heathkit tunnel dipper. They used a tunnel diode oscillator as the main oscillating network instead of a 6C42. The original Heathkit grid dip meter used a 6 Charlie 4 triode tube. Nice miniature little triode that, if you use it just right, would go up to quite a few hundred megacycles. And the tunnel dipper had the ability to go a little bit further. That's the good news. The problem with tunnel diodes is to make them have clean oscillating characteristics requires very careful adjustment of the bias. That's problem number one. Problem number two, the way you manufacture a tunnel diode is to put extremely heavy doping into a diode. That's one of the characteristics. Unfortunately, that very heavy doping of other materials into the PN junction slowly changes in time. So all of my experience with any electronics that ever had a tunnel diode in it is that it worked beautifully today, but a month or two from now, we had to readjust the bias in order to get back to the same operation, because all of those doping materials were slowly migrating inside of that tunnel diode, and his exact curve of tunnel diode characteristics was slowly, continuously shifting. That's one of the reasons why tunnel diodes became unpopular. At the time, tunnel diodes would allow you to build an oscillator at, let me pick a number, 3 gigahertz, when there weren't transistors that went beyond 150 megacycles. So the tunnel diode, for a short period of time, looked like it was a great solution for higher frequency operation. But people rapidly found out that tunnel diodes have got some other characteristics that are not so easy to live with. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Repeater, timeout,
cancel.
Now, Roger, yeah, I bought one of the last known when they came out with their FDP wrist zipper, and then I modified it. I added a digital readout to it. Let's see. Yeah, so, not many hands, of course, have access to things like a network analyzer or more needed, really. But if they're going to just, do... some hands-on radio, which I call all this stuff, is basically we learned it by hands-on, besides, studying the theory. I think I saw a grid zip needed today in one of the piles of odds and ends there at the ham set, and I don't think there was any tape. I think these things are just all by the wayside, but it's a shame because, like you say, how much you can tell about that, or if you have guys, for instance, if you were to pick up or want a homebrew, a good old linear amplifier with a couple of tubes in it, you'd like to do a lot of testing before you go ahead and actually apply the power of the plate voltage. The grid zip meter is a wonderful tool, and it's a simple device, like you just said. I'm going to use some very simple ones, the 64. And then they came out with the solid-state versions and all. But I don't think you're going to find many hands today that even know the concept of a grid zip meter anymore. Too bad that these things are just fading into, like they say, going off into the sunset. But it shows you just here that these old-timers really had, good, clever ideas with very little that they had to work with over
time. Not a way to the beat. Don't lose a whole lot of sleep over the fact that grid zip meters have become obsolete now. That particular product, somewhat like the slide rule, don't really need it anymore. You really can't do without it. Yes, a laboratory-grade network analyzer is kind of expensive, and very few of them ever appear on the flea market. The ones that appear on the flea market are the very, very early versions of Hewlett Packard that by modern standards are very hard to use, and they're almost not worth the effort, in my opinion. However, we do have access to the poor man's equivalent of a network analyzer. I think it's AEA and MFJ. Both sell something called antenna analyzer. It's a machine that will give you a swept curve of standing wave ratio of your antenna versus frequency. And there's various ways you can set the dials to sweep a wide region, a narrow region, high sensitivity, low sensitivity. That is a network analyzer, Mel. And so a smart, modern-day ham can buy a not-too-expensive antenna analyzer, and if he uses it correctly, he's going to get 95% of all the answers he would have gotten out of a laboratory-grade network analyzer. A little bit less accuracy, but it's going to get them into the ballpark. So we haven't lost. For the most part, I think we've gained. Mel, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, because, there was an article that the USB of an adapter that fellow came up with to add to the MFJ antenna analyzer to determine the Q of a coil. I mean, you may have seen that. And he more or less, like you say, using the equivalent of the grid zip meter and all, But I guess, you know what it is, I'm thinking back how you think with the meter and stick it in there to the receiver, the transmitter, look at the stages and all. And I got so familiar with that with the meter that I could even use it for some TV servicing, Dick. So I know I date myself, but I thought this was a real interesting phenomenon, how they went ahead and measured Q with, grid demeanor. I guess you could do it, most likely, with this method, using, an antenna analog, like AEA or MFJ, or for the antenna smith. I would assume that you most likely could figure a way of, making an adapter to hook a small coil or anything, something onto it, and measure Q with it, I would assume, over.
Absolutely. And a grid dip meter used to be a poor man's signal generator, Mel. I can remember on a couple of occasions when I was in the radio and television repair business, somebody would be complaining about television interference. And I would go to their house and I would see a certain kind of herringbone on the screen. With my grid dip meter, and by changing the spacing between the grid dip meter and the 300 ohm twin lead that used to be used in those days, I could get roughly the same amount of signal coupled into the television set as the interference that was coming and going. I could set the amplitude by setting the distance. I could set the frequency on the dial of the grid dip meter until I saw a similar sounding or similar looking herringbone response on the screen. I was able to, within some degree, predict what frequency the interference was. I didn't have a scannable receiver in those days, A scanner receiver would have been very handy in order to find the interference, or a spectrum analyzer would have been very handy. I didn't have that. With a grid dip meter, within a small degree of inaccuracy, I could predict what frequency was giving them an interference, and once you knew the frequency, it helped you pin it down. So it was a poor man's signal generator. You could have a grand old time with that. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, that's right. It was a very handy gadget, and I just say a very simple gadget, and I'm sure there are many hams out there that do not have the money to even buy one of these more sophisticated antenna analyzers, but they do go into $100, whereas I know the grid meter is a fairly simple thing to put together even today. You most likely can construct one fairly easy. I don't know if it's in the handbooks anymore how to put such a thing together, but just they used to be in the old handbooks. Of course, they showed you how to homebrew all these different types of little testing devices. So, for maybe a young ham and would like to do some hands-on experiments and all, and don't have the wherewithal to go out and buy one of these. They do go up in money, the good ones, like AEA and everything, antenna smith and all. They are really up there in the buff now. I mean, for somebody that's, new to the hobby, a simple grid meter, if you can find one or, make one, I guess you can look back at some of the older USBs or whatever, for a few dollars, you got yourself a very handy instrument. And today, with using the computer receiver with the digital readout and everything, you can amazingly get some very accurate measurements of coils and little devices like, small variable condensers, choke things. In other words, do some real basic hands-on experiments. That's the way I think radio, getting back to that, how they should teach, and they don't anymore. But hands-on, I think, is really something that should be start at the bottom. You got to build a building. You got to put a foundation in. There's too much today taken for granted. And I talk to a lot of these young people. You see what happens. They don't have the basic foundation. That's where they're getting into problems. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're absolutely rich recognizer. You're absolutely right that real radio knowledge, particularly antenna knowledge, a high percentage of it comes from hands-on experience and mentoring by somebody, whether it be your local Elmer because you're a ham radio operator, or you've got the old codger working for the company that you're at, and you arrange to have lunch times with him, and you talk to him about radio in the so-called good old days, and you tell He tells you how it's done, and he goes to the laboratory during his lunch period and shows you. The schools don't teach wireless very much. The majority of it comes from hands-on. But when it comes to that expensive piece of test equipment you'd like to have, Mel, take a very progressive club like Kings County Radio Club. If the membership decides that they really like to have a nice piece of test equipment, and maybe it's the Cadillac version of an antenna analyzer, or maybe it's a real network analyzer or a real spectrum analyzer, a club like yours with affluent guys and a good community like that could elect as a group to pool their resources, buy one of those nice pieces of equipment, and share it among the membership. Some of the really good clubs are doing that. So as long as you can get agreement among the members that, yeah, two-thirds of them would love to have one of these machines, and even if you lay down all the cash of your own and you tapped into your retirement nest egg and bought one, realistically, you wouldn't be using it every day. You'd use it once a week or three times a month. As such, sharing it with the rest of your buddies in the club is a nicer way to go. So do consider that, in my opinion. But in my occupation now, I'm spending 20% when I go to the salt mine of my main client, 20% of my time is spent mentoring the new antenna or the new RF engineers that have joined the organization, because there's no school in the world, with rare exceptions, that teaches the art and science of wireless. It has to be taught with hands-on application and experience. And you take an old codger like me, and I think I told you last week, there was one particular guy the company wanted to hire, and because the guy was reasonably enthusiastic about the way I interviewed him, he was on the fence as to whether or not they're going to join the company, and the company said to him, okay, if you do join us, we will let you talk to Dick some number of time, some number of hours per week. He will be giving you instruction, and I was told that, that was one of the reasons that particular individual decided to join the company. Rich wanted to make a comment, N2EO, go ahead, Rich.
WHCDL opened the Dick.
Okay, everybody's got to start waiting for the beep. Rich first, and then we're going to go over to Andy. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I hope you can understand me. On the website for MFK, MFK sells something called an MFK 201, 1.5 to 250 megahertz bit meter. I believe from looking at it, uses internal diodes, comes with six coils. By the way, you should know, Dick, I was just on Amazon.com. I purchased a used white new condition HP 48GX.
Yeah, that 48GX is an excellent machine. I own one of those. And it can do magic. It's got something like 3,000 or 4,000 commands that you can go to buried in that machine. But the menus you have to go through to get to them is a little bit troublesome. But there are certain kinds of calculations where only that machine can do it, and I bought one of those just for that reason. Now, let's see what Andy's got to say. I bet you own some pretty darn good test equipment, Andy, and I bet you from time to time you've talked your particular club into buying some good stuff so it can be shared among the members. So the A2CDL, the technical maven of Limark, K2RIW.
All right, very good. And hello again to the guys that I saw at the ham fair, the Hall of Science. I saw Mel this morning. I'm not going to hold it long. I got, I'm in the middle of a few things going on over here. And, I think I have enough equipment I could do just about anything I want to do. And you're right about hands-on, because that's where you really were. But Dick, I wanted to tell you, if you didn't already know, we now have IRLP connected to the Selden repeater. We have a DSL line, which was installed for the first time last week. And we have a computer
running Linux at the location at the site connected up to the repeater. We're going to be doing the linking next between repeaters. So there'll be the capability at times to publicize the TechNet through ILLP to other repeaters. I'm going to have a chance to play with this because I'm going down south and I'll be bringing up the links and I'll be talking from repeater A to repeater B through the internet. So we're going to see how that works out. So I think I just thought I'd tell you that we're moving forward with that. And next few months will be, the linking will be done, and then some of the voting stuff will be done too. So we're getting there. Just wanted to tell you, Dick, back to you, and then I'm going to sign out because I have to get ready for tomorrow.
Very fine, Andy. Congratulations on that. Boy, am I forgetful. I can't think of the name of this process now by which you can talk into one computer, it goes to a internet line, comes out of another computer in Florida or Australia. Why can't I think of the name of that?
The
Echo Link? Echo Link is what I'm talking about. And how does IRLP differ from Echo Link? I'm guessing that in the case of IRLP, by way of dialing into a particular website, you can decide which computer you come out of, which repeater you come out of and into. And I think Echo Link has some of that capability. So give me a couple of words on what the difference is, Andy.
Basically, IRLP is only accessed via a radio gateway into the internet through a node number, as opposed to Echo Link, where you could bring up your node or the node you want to access from your home computer connected to the internet. And from your home computer, you can key up a repeater. IRLP does not work that way. IRLP is simply IRLP, the Internet Repeater Linking Project. But all of the bottom line to IRLP is to connect repeaters together using VoIP, voice over IP, over the internet, and that is it. There are some other functions which you can do for control, but that's the main difference between IRLP, where again, you can only access it through a radio, and Echo Link, where you can access Echo Link through your computer, home computer. So if you wanted to have a QSO, do it from your home computer. Basically, that just like sums that up right now. All right, one more, and then I have to get going because it's getting late for me.
Yeah, the next question I've got is, I've heard people on the air, when properly programming their local programming, setting up whatever, their local repeater, they were talking with what it was equivalent to a handy-talkie or a mobile rig, into their repeater, the signal was coming out of that repeater, the audio was coming out of a repeater that was a zillion miles away, and so from their automobile, they were holding a QSO with somebody in, we'll say Florida, their favorite buddy in Florida, and the buddy in Florida was either in his home or in his mobile and talking back to him. The people doing that called it Echo Link. I think you're telling me it really was IRLP. Back to you, Andy.
Well, you could access... I have to think about accessing Echo Link from your car, because you could access Echo Link from a home computer or from a radio that has that node number. So if you're going through a repeater that's connected to Echo Link and you're in your car, you could access Echo Link from your car. That's possible. And that is done. And again, of course, IRLP, you could do that as well. If the repeater that you're accessing as an IRLD node, you just punch in the node number, and then you could punch in the node number of the repeater you want to connect to, and that repeater that you're going through will connect to the other that you want to go to. So it will work in both cases. All right, with that 73, I will book you further down. WHCDL.
35, Andy. Thank you for checking in. Good luck with that project. Sounds like it's going to get to be a lot of fun. And a quick break. Let's see if Barry into Moonbound is still with us, because I've got to see some information for him. Barry, are you there?
I sure am. And I just might want to add that there's very little difference, actually, between IRLD and Echolink. The only difference, I think, is that Echolink has a few more enhancements, things that you cannot do with IRLD. IRLD is deliberately set up in such a way that they don't want you going in from your home computer. They want you to go into your local repeater, and then through IRLD, that repeater will speak to another one. And it's just their preference, you know, how they wish to do it. That can definitely be done with Echolink. With Echolink, you can also do a number of other little tricks, like you could have a radio set up in your house, you talk to your radio from your car, a node or whatever they call it, or a link or something, and then that radio is connected not necessarily to the air, it's on the internet, and that is putting it to some other place in the world if you wish, and, like that. So there's a dozen ways to do it. I mean, it's like almost endless, over.
Good to know. Thank you. Write down this number, MRF 899. Mike, radio frequency, Motorola radio frequency, 899. Google that number, get a data sheet, read that data sheet, and you're going to say, wow, that's a transistor. 150 watts output, each individual transistor, easily combined into as many as you want. Something like 260 watts of dissipation capability. So the thing can tolerate, I think it's a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio forever. Before you add any kind of a linearizing network, it'll do a two-tone test, 31 or 32 dB down, at full 150 watts peak envelope power output. The transistor itself is a little bit on the expensive side. It's rated for 800 to 950 megacycles. That's the good news. Runs high efficiency, high gain. Stucci is all hell. You can hit it with a hammer and the thing just keeps on cranking. Let me drop. And so to buy the transistors and use them, that's enthusiastic. You go to a website where you start searching down ELPA amplifiers, E-L-P-A, those four-letter abbreviations. You may find it under MRF 899 plus 600 watts or MRF 899, 300 watts. What I'm getting at is on the surplus market, there are combinations of those transistors where they put four of them together and they get 600 watts of output, or they put two of them together and they get 300 watts of output, and there's a whole lot of driver stages and power supplies and regulators and heat sinks and blowers and everything else in this beautiful amplifier that you pick up with one hand, and it's a plug-and-play type thing. These things originally cost amplifier assembly numbers like $5,000 a copy. And you can buy it for $150 on the surplus market in like new condition, ready to roll. Just give it the 26 volts and plus 10 dBm of drive, and out comes all of those watts, 600 watts, 300 watts. There's a 600 watt version, 300 watt version, and 150 watt version of those amplifiers on the surplus market. A lot of power for the money. A lot of stuff for the money. These are the amplifier sections of each of those amplifiers with that transistor in it is made with this ceramic, why can't I think of the name of it now, alumina substrate. Beautifully well heat-sink, extremely well designed, rugged as all hell amplifiers. A lot of stuff for the money. That's the good news. The bad news, because it's made for 800 to 950 megacycles, can you tune it up as high as 1296? I don't know. The guys on 902 to 928 megs just love these amplifiers, and they're the ones that are scoffing them up right now. I don't know if anybody's put one on 1296 yet, but I think it's just possibly doable. And who cares if the 150-watt transistor comes down to 100 watts per stage because you've moved it all the way up to 1296. That's still a lot of hardware for the money. And so with a little bit of risk factor, I think you could try one of those. Get to me on the telephone. I'll give you a little bit more inside information on this if you want. Back to you, Barry. Wait for the beep.
Okay, real good. Yeah, I, of course, want the big one. I got to have power on 1296. So that's a given. I'm not going to call you tonight. I'll probably call you tomorrow, late in the afternoon when I get home. You used a term on the radio today, which I suppose I should know, but I never heard it before. You said snowflaking. Whatever does that mean?
Boy, am I glad you asked. We've only got a minute or two left. If you take a microstrip printed circuit, doesn't matter if it's aluminum substrate, FR4 board, or whatever, G10 board, and you take little bitty chunks of copper on the end of a toothpick, and you just touch the printed circuit microstrip in the right spot. You're adding a stray capacitor, a stray inductor, or whatever, and you watch the response on your network analyzer, your spectrum analyzer, your power output meter, whatever. You pick up these little chunks of copper, and you say, gee, when I add one here, I've moved this thing from 928 megs, I've moved it down to 902 megs, and now I've got 2 more dB of power output. And you find the right spot, you either glue it down or solder it down. And then you go pick up another one and do it again. That whole process is called snowflaking. You've seen it, you've heard of it, you just didn't hear it under those words. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, but of course, we don't want to go down, we want to go up the frequency. And you can do that by adding stuff to it? I guess you can.
Yes, in that case, you're not adding a little snowflake square to make a capacitor. You're adding a strip of material to make the line wider in the right spot to lower its D0, its characteristic impedance in that spot, in order to give you a better impedance match at your frequency. So there's various versions of snowflake. And the next step beyond that is to put shunt inductors and whatever in the right place. There's ways of taking a circuit that was tuned to frequency A and moving it to frequency B. I will admit moving down is a hell of a lot easier than moving up. And unfortunately, if you want to move up, it's a little bit more difficult. There is some risk factor in here. But when you start off with that much capability and that much power, if you could get 50% of the capability at your frequency, I think you'd be happy.
Yeah, I sure do. And I bet if I spoke to the right person, he might suggest where I would put those little pieces of metal to get started. And I suppose I might, it's probably a printed circuit board, so I imagine I can also take pieces of foil away and maybe achieve it that way, or shorten something. But I think I'll get one in hand, and then I'll take a photograph of it, and then I'll share it with somebody, you know who, and we might have some suggestions.
You go to the right website or even to the right eBay advertisement for these amplifiers that are being showed, you're going to see a beautiful high-resolution color picture of these assemblies. And if you go to the right website, this guy in Dallas-Fort Worth area, I can't think of his call letters right now, his name is Matt, M-A-T-T-S, first name, last name is Swedish, he tells you how to take the amplifier and convert it for your particular frequency range. So there's a lot of power there, Barry. Go ahead.
Beautiful. Okay, there's obviously a phone call coming up on this thing. Okay, real good, Rick. I think we're going to lose this thing in a few moments. And I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you very much for that information. You know darn well I'm going to do it. That is my project. That's the next one. I got to have power on 1296. Sounds like it's going to cost me about $1,000 less than if I did it any other way.
There's a little bit of risk in this technique, but boy, it's got an awful lot of capability and maybe worth it. And even if at worst, you don't get it up to 1296, and you become the strongest guy with the most compact Stucci amplifier on 902, even that way you're going to be happy. The 902 guys just can't get enough of these things. Mel, I better turn it over to you real fast because I think it's time for you and I to say goodbye to each other for tonight. And what's the break for you? Do you think we're going to be recording on next week? K2KUY, K2LIW, he's still there.
And K2BXL, man.